You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have what I'd like to call, who I'd like to refer to as the Lord of Cheese, the honorable Professor Paul Kinstead. He is out of University of Vermont. His favorite cheese, in fact, I know this off the record, is a flaky aged Vermont cheddar. I'm just going to guess.
There you go.
And he's in the case. You can't tweet him. He doesn't have time for Twitter, Instagram. He's too busy making cheese. Your book, Cheese and Culture, fascinating about cheese's role, not only in history, but the technology behind making cheese. And people are like, what are you doing? I was going to do an Instagram saying, I got to go do an Instagram. I'm talking to the foremost expert on cheese. I got a lot of questions on cheese because I do. My favorite food probably is cheese, although I'm a little lactose intolerant. I deal with it anyway. Can you tell me how much we owe to cheese? I know that the Romans carried it with them, sort of a salty pecorino, and it kept them fighting longer than they'd be able to. So cheese basically is responsible for a lot of bloodshed. True or false?
cheese has been part of the military since before the Romans, actually the Hittites before them in the Bronze Age, and ever since cheese has marched with or sailed with military armies, navies, and so forth. So absolutely, cheese helped fuel some pretty gruesome events in human history.
what got you involved in making cheese and in cheese in general?
Well, I grew up as a kid, my early years, next to a dairy farm in eastern Massachusetts, and I used to love to go out and play in the pastures with the cows and, you know, hop over the cow pies and so forth. And by the time I was 7 years old, the pastures were abandoned and houses started coming up, and I watched the landscape of eastern Massachusetts just be transformed. And this was the time of the great high-tech boom around Route 128 and, you know, the Boston arc around Boston, and we were part of that. My dad worked for IBM. So I was, as a kid, actually devastated to lose this wonderful environment that I grew up in. Eventually, I went to college, started out at the University of Chicago as a pre-medical student. I was going to be a medical doctor. And I didn't like the city. I didn't like Chicago, and I loved the university, but the city was a drag, the South Side. Decided to go back to my roots, boyhood roots, and go to the University of Vermont, transfer after my freshman year, and kind of stumbled into dairy technology as a major, as a second-year student, because I was able to get in-state tuition at the University of Vermont if I took that particular major through a New England regional program. So I stumbled into dairy. Random stumbling.
So you studied dairy technology. So when back in the day, and probably still in parts of Europe, how would I make cheese? And let me start by giving you how I think I'd make cheese, and then you tell me if I'm right or wrong. I would take milk. I would take rennet, which is the product that is inside a calf's intestine before it actually eats grass. I would put that in the milk. I'd tie it up in a waterproof sack of some kind, and then I'd hang it in a cave. And I'd come back a year later. I'm not done, Professor. I'd come back a year later, and I'd cut into that cheese, and it'd be delicious.
When Brian cut into that sack a year later, describe what he would find.
Oh, gosh. That sounds like it would be it would be hard to get to the sack. The odor would be so strong and objectionable. But if you did that, it would be almost liquid goo flowing out. That's close to cheese making, but not quite.
All right. Tell me what I did wrong.
Well, first of all, there are three different great families of cheese that have different manufacturing procedures. Very different, that give rise to three very different families. So what you talked about are the rennet coagulated cheeses, which account for the large majority of cheeses across the world. Most of the diversity in the ripened cheeses are all what you described, the rennet coagulated cheeses. But what is critical is to get some of that, after you coagulate the milk with the rennet that comes from the stomachs of the calves, like you explained, that's all correct, then that curd has to be manipulated to get squeeze out some of the whey, the water in that curd, to get the moisture down so it becomes more stable and can age and not rot away. You didn't do that in your description. You left all the whey in the curd.
I left the whey in the curd. So would I wait for the calf? Would I have to kill a calf to get the rennet, or do I wait till it just kind of defecates?
No. You would take that calf. There's always a surplus in animal husbandry practices of male calves because you don't need them. You're raising the females for milking purposes.
Okay.
So there's always male calves. You take them and slaughter them before they're weaned, so they're still milk-fed. Remove the true stomach. You know, the calf has four stomachs, but there's only one that's a genuine stomach, and you choose that genuine stomach, and you dry it and salt it, and then that rennet that's in the stomach lining becomes stable. And so you can store the rennets salted and dried for extended long periods of time, and pull out a piece of this dried rennet and stick it in the milk, you know, whenever you're trying to make cheese. So that's where the rennet would come from.
Oh, wow. So you do have to kill. So a cow, every time I bite into a piece of cheese, technically, at least if I lived back in the day, a calf had to die for my morsel of cheese, essentially.
Yes and no. The reason I say no is because there are other sources of that type of enzyme that coagulates milk that are plant sources that were very common in, for example, the Roman times or the Greek times, all the way back to Hittite times and probably even earlier than that.
Wow.
And I'm talking about like fig sap. If you take a green branch from the fig tree and just mm-hmm. break it open, and there's sap that will exude out of it, that sap contains an enzyme very much like what's in the stomach lining of a calf. Put that sap in the milk and bang, it coagulates. Homer talked about this in the Iliad, for example, and
wow.
used it as a metaphor for the healing of Ares when he got really socked by Athena during a battle and got a sword in his side.
But
so there's the fig sap, and then there's thistles that grow all over the Mediterranean that... you can take the flowers of these thistles, they're weeds basically, and soak them in water, and there's an enzyme in the leaves, in the flowers that you can extract, and then add that extract to milk and it will coagulate. So it doesn't necessarily require the slaughtering of an animal, but many cheeses do require that type of rennet, but not all.
So for vegans who indiscriminately eat cheese, they're probably still contributing to the slaughtering of animals. If they do it indiscriminately and aren't checking out what the source
of... Well, vegans don't eat cheese.
No, for vegetarians, I meant.
Oh, vegetarians.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, if they don't read the label, typically if cheese is made from non-animal rennet, they will advertise that because there's a market for amongst vegetarians for that type of cheese. So it should be on the label and should say something like enzymes as opposed to rennet. Rennet is a term that's related to animal sources, so... There's ways to scope out whether your cheese is made with animal rennet or not.
Wow.
One of the stories that I was really glad that you cleared up, because so often we hear the story that the way that cheese, there's this sort of cheese mythology invention story that at some point there was a man and he was transporting milk and, you know, he had put mm-hmm. milk inside the stomach of a calf and then, you know, it got shaken up as it was being transported along and then he opened it up and he found curds and whey. And thus was
right.
cheese born. And there are some real, real problems with this story in terms of the scientific evidence, right?
Yeah, and the problem is that the cheese making, and we have really pretty good evidence now in terms of the archaeological and forensic chemical evidence that you can derive from artifacts from, in this case, 9,000 years ago, 7,000 BC. It's
cheese, cheese has been around. Cheese has been around that long.
Well, just about, yeah. The milk harvesting definitively began on a large scale. This is the Fertile Crescent region of the Near East that we're talking about. Milk harvesting began around 7,000 BC, and we know that from residues of dairy fat that you can extract from little pieces of pottery that were used 9,000 years ago, 7,000
wow.
BC.
Wow.
Still have the, yeah. And we know that almost certainly that it wasn't simply liquid milk that was stored in these pots 9,000 years ago, but it was a concentrated form of dairy product, almost certainly cheese, because of the type of residue and the fact that it etches into these bits of pottery. So cheese making began, you know, somewhere. Dairying begins around 7,000 BC. Cheese making probably almost immediately thereafter. And at this point in human history, adult humans are essentially universally lactose intolerant. So when milk harvesting and cheese making begins, adults can't drink milk without some, you know, fairly significant repercussions, you know, symptoms of lactose. If you know it, real folks who are really lactose intolerant, it's not a pretty picture.
Yeah, it hurts.
And, and so that's a disincentive for that nomad riding on the camel to pull out his canteen of milk and drink it in the myth that you've talked about. It wasn't for another 1,500 years that lactose tolerance into adulthood, or lactase persistence, as it's called, comes in terms of the genetic genome, human genome, comes online. And we know that because of really recent research and genomic investigative methods that we can track the origins of lactase persistence, or when adults began to tolerate lactose. And it was 5,500 BC in Central Europe, 1,500 years after milk had been harvested and cheese had been made. So there was plenty of time for the Neolithic populations that were harvesting milk, making cheese, to figure out the remnant long before adults were drinking milk as a beverage, is the argument that I make.
Okay.
See,
that doesn't seem to hold a lot of water.
But that's what I love, is that when you sort through all of the data, you start to be able to unravel what must have happened so many thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
If adult humans weren't drinking milk until 5,500 BC, then it couldn't have been that cheese was the result of some accidental milk drinking vessel gone wrong.
Well,
perfect.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'm fascinated with man's knowledge of chemistry back then, to say that the flower of a thistle or the enzyme in fig sap, or my God, let's figure out a way to extract the water from rennet, take the whey out of rennet, and then we'll put it in milk. And then we'll hang it in a cave, and apparently it'll turn to cheese. That seems to me like more than just an accident. It seems to me that somebody was experimenting and had a notion of chemistry.
That's a great point. And I would argue that the Neolithic people were not dumb. They had to survive, and to survive was not an easy task in those days.
Yeah.
And so they were constantly experimenting with foods and potential foods. I mean, they would have understood intuitively that milk is really valuable, because human babies survive on milk for their first couple of years before they're weaned, and all mammals survive on milk. So milk, you know, intuitively was precious. The question was how to preserve it in a way that they could actually use it.
Well, also how to preserve it in a way that so when you eat cheese or yogurt, Some people can't drink milk, but a lot of people can eat cheese and yogurt, at least in Europe and things. Is that process by which you do this with cheese, is that what kills off the lactase or the lactose?
Yeah, the lactose is a sugar, a carbohydrate that you can't break down in your GI tract, and so it gets fermented in your gut and by the bad guys, the bacteria that is there that you really don't want to favor, and that's the problem. If you can't break down the lactose, it goes to the bad guys, and then they cause all these, you know, problems of bloating and gas, and also diarrhea and so forth. So, making of cheese, even the most simple fresh cheeses, I'm not talking about a dry aged cheese, but even the very simplest cheeses, the lactose is decreased by roughly 80% at least. In the cheese-making process, when the whey drains off, the lactose follows the whey, and so right away, the most simplest cheeses that would have been stumbled upon first would be significantly lower in lactose. And, you know, some adventurous adult tried this coagulated stuff, you know, this curd, fresh cheese, and found, geez, I can eat some of this, and I'm not having a problem. And, you know, then that began, I'm assuming or hypothesizing that the whole process of trial and error that led to the first early simple cheeses. And from there, the rest is history. Because if you follow the archaeological record of these Neolithic peoples who developed dairying and cheese making for the first time, you can track them and their migrations, because they were spreading in every direction from this point on. And you can follow them by the material record in the archaeological strata and see that they preserved their ability to make cheese and their dairying lifestyle wherever they went.
Right.
It was so valuable. They knew this was a good thing, and they took it with them wherever they went.
So I have two questions then. So the drier the cheese, the lower the lactose?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, so then here's my next question. Is it easier to digest raw milk cheese than pasteurized milk cheese? Because, you know, raw milk cheese in California is all the rage, right? I mean, I get raw goat milk, which is why I have such a virile... what's the word? Visage or just presence?
Is that why you're so horny, Brian?
Yeah, that must be it. Please, we have an academic on.
I'm sorry.
I'm not going to ask about that.
Yeah, no, but is there any what about the difference between raw milk cheese and regular cheese? Is raw milk easier to digest? Does it have? I heard it has lactase. And so the lactase, or maybe the lactose, has been unadulterated. What is that, or is it just as hard to digest?
Yeah, well, the difference between raw milk cheese primarily is in the heat treatment of pasteurization. If it's pasteurized milk cheese, that some of the natural enzymes in milk that carry over into cheese normally are inactivated during pasteurization, and also some of the bacteria that are present naturally in milk as sort of natural as natural contaminants or inhabitants, many of them are wiped out by the heat treatment. So the milk has a less enzymatic load and a less microbial load, fewer bacteria, fewer enzymes. But those enzymes really are not. I don't think there's any evidence that the residual lactose in cheese is lower in a raw milk cheese necessarily than in a pasteurized milk cheese. In terms of lactose tolerance, I don't think there's any particular benefit of a raw milk cheese versus a
raw milk does have more enzymes. Do you think raw milk is, provided it's pure and all that and clean, do you think raw milk,
yep.
There's an argument that raw milk is probably better for you than pasteurized milk, especially if you're growing and things?
Well, it makes a better, I'm going to show my opinion here. It makes for a better cheese, and oftentimes for aged cheeses, because the enzymes that I talked about and microorganisms that pasteurization wipes out oftentimes contribute to various flavor reactions that lead to nice nuances of flavor and so forth that are hard to duplicate in a pasteurized milk cheese. So you tend to get a greater depth and variety of flavors in raw milk cheese relative to the same type of cheese made from pasteurized milk. So there's some benefits, I would argue, in terms of flavor quality and sensory properties of raw milk, for sure. For health benefits, I think that's very, I know that there's a sort of a mythology out there that raw milk is raw milk has a lot of health benefits, and there's some claims that are really interesting and I think are being looked at scientifically in the schools out in terms of the validity of the claims. But for cheese, I don't know of any really credible evidence that raw milk cheese has health benefits.
Right.
I think there's clear evidence that in terms of the depth of flavor and the nuances of flavor that are possible, raw milk has some real advantages.
Do the Europeans use raw milk for the most part, or are they more purists about this stuff, or do they use pasteurized milk?
They use both. They're much more dedicated to raw milk, and especially the further south you go in Europe, the more traditional and small scale and artisanal and dedicated to raw milk and traditional cheese technologies they become. So, you know, there's a lot of industrial cheese made, particularly in, you know, from France and Central Europe northwards, where it's very much like the United States.
Well, what is ultra-pasteurization in relation to pasteurization? What's the difference?
It's a much higher higher temperature. It's a very, you know, it's a flash, very short time of heating, and it's it almost sterilizes the product. So it's a much more severe heat treatment.
It can't be as good for you. It seems like it kills all the vitamins and all the enzymes, and it's kind of white water at that point, isn't it?
Well, you know, again, that's a controversial area. Because it's a very short heat treatment, although it's very intense, it doesn't cause the kind of changes that if you boil milk, you know, and blast the thing for a long period of time, happens. But it does change, you know, some of the sensory properties. It's, you know, flavor's a little bit different, and there are some changes. But I think it's controversial as to whether, you know, like the nutritional quality is degraded. I don't think there's a lot of really hard evidence to support that.
Well, I heard we had somebody on the podcast who said basically Europe, a lot of Europe lived on potatoes and dairy products, cheese, and we're pretty healthy doing it. Is that?
Dairy is great. Potatoes are great, but potatoes are pretty limited. But the dairy helps out enormously.
Yeah.
When you combine, I mean, I think what he was really talking about was like even simple mashed potatoes. As soon as you take a dairy, you know, some butter, and you put it together with some potatoes, you have pretty much a nutritionally complete food.
It's pretty crazy.
The other things that I really want to talk about is also the intersection of climate and cheese. One of the things that I thought was so fascinating is India never really developed a very sophisticated cheese-making culture. They developed paneer, but they never really went beyond that. And part of the point you made in the book is that's a natural response to their environment, where because it's so hot and other qualities of the environment, there was never really any incentive to develop it.
Yeah, that's a tough place to make cheese because of the humidity, the heat, the monsoons that come seasonally, and the environment, the temperature, climate conditions are very variable. All of that makes it difficult to make cheese, especially the heat, and that means that when early Indian farmers experimented with cheeses, if they tried to age the cheese, it would tend to rot away, and that then intersects with you know, sort of the Aryan philosophy. The Aryans being a pastoral people that moved into India
from Persia, you know, right? Yeah,
from the Central Asia, Persia, about 1700 BC. They begin to write the Hindu scriptures, the Vedas, around 1500 BC. They're the basis for Hindu culture that then becomes so pivotal and foundational to India and for Buddhism and Jainism and all that would follow. And in Hindu culture, in the Vedas, food purity is so central to food culinary experience. That food has to be pure. Any kind of rotting or degradation or spoilage was not only considered bad hygiene, bad nutrition, but also has implications spiritually, that your spiritual health is influenced by the purity of your food. And so what a, you know, 1-2 punch against cheese, which is basically controlled rotting of milk in a context like that of hot and humid and a cultural context that doesn't have a high tolerance for maggoty, you know, moldy type cheese that became so beloved in Europe.
Maggoty and moldy.
Well, I think
really?
You should talk about Kazumarzu, if that's how you pronounce it, the Sardinian maggot cheese.
Yeah,
I'd like to talk about that. Maggot cheese, please.
It was a constant problem that maggots, you know, flies are everywhere on farms, and cheese was made on farms, and so the flies would find a nice hospitable environment to lay their eggs, which would often be in cracks and crevices on the rind or the surface of the cheese, and then they would hatch, and maggots were a way of life. That was, you know, you had to develop a a tolerance for maggots. And in fact, there's some cheeses that actually became beloved for their maggoty nature.
They're maggot. So you would eat? Would you eat the maggots, or just they just left a residue, a little maggot juice?
I think you pick them off, but you know, maggots were just a way of life.
Our sound engineer Rena is literally shaking, and she's doing weird things with her hands. She's got the heebie-jeebies. Don't be such a baby, Rena. It's just baby flies.
Crawling around in your food.
There you go.
Yeah.
I like your attitude.
How long does it take typically for a really good aged provolone or one of the cheeses I love, or that great Parmesan Reggiano you pay $1 million a sliver for at Whole Foods? I mean, how much, you know, that aged Parmesan, I guess, well, it takes 24 months, doesn't it? It can take up to 24 months, 2 years.
Yeah, I don't touch a Parmesan Reggiano cheese, for example, until it's 2 years old. And you know, if it's 3 years, all the better. It just gets better with time,
really?
Up to a point. These things are almost indestructible. They'll last forever. They'll become more and more granular. Actually, this is an area of research. I was just in Ireland last week reporting on Parmigiano Reggiano crystallization phenomena, which is what happens at 2, 3, 4 years of age, where the cheese structure really just changes dramatically, and crystals of various sorts take over the structure, and it gives it that granularity that makes it such a wonderful grating cheese, as well as the powerful flavor that's coming from other biochemical reactions.
I'm getting horny here. Take it easy.
But that's all that raw goat's milk.
It must be the goat milk. Sorry, it must be the goat milk. Just all the talk about my favorite cheese.
Brian will from now on be saying that he doesn't touch a Parmigiano Reggiano that's at least 2 years
You're
old.
You're damn right.
That's
You're
right.
damn right. And I'm not giving you any of the credit, Professor. I'll tell you that much right now.
That's just my own personal preference. That's all.
It's now Brian's.
I'm loving it. I want to jump back really quickly to make sure now I know how to make rennet cheese. I would take the true stomach from the calf. I would salt it. I would then take pieces of that rennet. I would stick it in milk. I would tie it up in a bladder of some kind. Hang it in a cave. I'm not hanging in some. I'm hanging in a cave. And
let me back up because you missed a step there.
Damn.
You add the rennet to the milk. The milk at this point is liquid. Within minutes to an hour, that milk becomes a pudding-like consistency. It's a gel.
Really?
No longer a liquid.
From the rennet.
That's what coagulation is.
Wow, just from the enzyme in the rennet.
The rennet catalyzes a reaction that converts it from liquid to gel. At that point, you need to break up that gel and create surface area. You know, just break it up, and that's where cutting devices of all different types were developed in different places to create surface area to one degree or another that would help in the expelling of this whey from the curd. You need to have surface area as the gateway to release whey. You didn't do that, and that's why I said your cheese hanging in the bag there is going to just rot away.
Oh, so I got to create sort of like a flat area where I can lay that gel out?
Well, it's in some kind of a coagulating vessel. It used to be a wooden pail or a ceramic pot, even earlier than that, and the rennet is added, the milk coagulates in the pot, and then you take a branch of a tree or some kind of a knife or a blade and cut it up into particles, kind of like cottage cheese, cubes, if you think of that. And that helps the whey to separate more efficiently, really critical.
And then what do I put it back together after that, or do I have to make cheese in small batches, is what you're saying?
Well, it depends on what kind of cheese you're going to make. If you want to make a really dry cheese, like a Parmigiano Reggiano, which is one of the driest.
Which I do. You can keep your softy cheesies. Go on. It's for communists.
All right. Well, what you need to do next then is don't, cut up the curd and let the whey start to separate. And then you're going to have to blast this thing with heat. It's called cooking or scalding. Mm. So that you're going to raise the temperature of these curd particles and the whey that's separating to about 130 Fahrenheit, which is pretty warm.
Yeah.
And you're going to stir and try and get, that will help the curds to shrink up, and it'll just squeeze out the whey to a much greater extent.
How long do I cook it for?
Or an hour, for for that type of cheese, this is a pretty severe heat treatment.
That's hard to do, though. How do you keep it at 130? Fire is a lot hotter than 130. So what are you doing to keep it there?
Yeah, well, the cheese makers who developed this type of a technology had to develop the equipment to do that. And that was one of the huge technological advances in history, was figuring out how to heat up the curd whey, how to cook the curd.
Which I'm sure led to other inventions and things, right? I mean, this is what's cool about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It took unique inventions to make virtually every variety of cheese has its own set of unique inventions that had to be figured out in order for that cheese to be made. And one of the questions I'm always interested in as a sort of a hack historian, cheese scientist, is why did they do this in the first place? There must have been some cultural forces or economic forces or environmental forces causing the cheesemaker to go down this route in the first place. There's some stress that they were trying to relieve. And
right.
There's always a good logical explanation for why a different cheese arose over here versus, you know, 100 miles away over here.
Mm. Who do you give credit? What nation, what people do you give credit to for coming up with, for inventing cheese? Is it the French? Is it the Gauls?
Oh, no. Don't tell us the French.
Right. No. It might be the Greeks.
The Hittites. Yes.
No, it's not the Greeks either. And the earliest evidence comes out of Turkey, out of Anatolia, or Turkey, the Anatolian Peninsula.
Yep, the Fertile Crescent.
And that region, and Syria, bordering Turkey, that region is really the hotbed of 9,000 years ago.
Wow.
Cheese making, dairying, really getting started. And then those people in Turkey jumped the Bosporus, jumped over to the Balkan Peninsula and migrated northwards up the Balkans to the Danube River. And then they followed the Danube into around the back of the Alps into Central Europe, and then eventually to the Rhine River. And then by 5,000 BC, 2,000 years later, they're at the North Sea. And then they jump over to the British Isles by 4,500 BC. And this is a cultural flow out of the Middle East.
I always think about, when you talk about this, I always think about how it's funny, because as you're expanding, your army's expanding, or you're conquering new territory, or you're just nomads, I know for sure the guy who I'm protecting, who I'm surrounding with shields and spears, is my cheesemaker. I want the cheese scientist. I want the guy, the Professor Paul Kinstead's of the world. You'd be well protected. I'd be like, you're not carrying a sword, you just keep making cheese, and I'll assign a special battalion to you. These are the things. I mean, that science, that, having to kind of like share those secrets, and it's fascinating, man.
Well, and it did such a good job of opening up trade networks as well, as they figured out how to make longer and larger and more durable cheeses. Then people have the ability to reach new markets, to ship much further. As the technology improves, that really drives trade networks as well. In fact, you've suggested that, perhaps some of the earliest trade networks were driven by cheese, because it was a commodity that could be transported over long distances easily.
Yeah, you bet. Cheese was right there with the, the spices and the perfumes and all the sort of high-end luxury goods that were traded initially.
It's still that way. Yeah, I mean,
absolutely.
And one of the things I think is interesting is that, and I may be wrong about this, but I feel like in this country, especially the United States, artisan cheeses are really all the rage now, where they weren't in the 80s and the 90s. I mean, now you got, people talk about raw cheese and how they wouldn't touch pasteurized milk cheese. And you go to Whole Foods and you've got, just incredible selection of different cheeses, all from Europe and all over the world. Is that true? It seems to, cheese has really become...
America is undergoing a cheese renaissance.
Yeah, renaissance. Yeah.
This is my lecture to the course I teach today, actually, is the resurgence of artisanal, farmstead, traditional cheesemaking in America, which had basically been extinct for, 75 years, disappeared off the face of our country. But that type of traditional cheesemaking persisted in Europe, and now it's being resurrected in this country, and it is the rage, and it's been amazing. The last 30 years, starting not too long after the, you know, sort of the 60s and 70s, the counterculture back to the land movement really was the beginnings of this resurrection of small-scale traditional artisan cheese and other, for that matter, other foods. The whole alternative agriculture movement came out of the 60s and the 70s. And it's just been gaining momentum ever since. In Vermont, we, you know, my first 15 years as a cheese scientist at the University of Vermont really was catering to the other end of the industry, the big pizza cheese makers, large industrial cheese makers. The biggest plants make 1 million pounds of cheese a day. You know, think of that.
Wow.
1 million pounds of milk come in on one side of the factory, and 1 million pounds of cheese leave every day.
How many pounds of milk does it take to make 1 pound of cheese?
On average, about 10 pounds of milk per 1 pound of cheese.
Wow. So that's a lot of cows. Wow.
When my career began, that was my understanding of cheese. It was made in large factories on enormous scales of production. And then as time went on, we get into the 90s, and I suddenly see across the Vermont landscape lots of artisan farmstead cheesemakers springing up. And of course they come to me because I'm the cheese guy at the university when they need help. And I get more and more involved with the artisans.
Wow.
At this point, I work a lot with those folks, and my industrial cheesemakers have all gone out and they've left the state for, you know, factories in the desert, basically, of the Southwest.
Yeah, I wonder, have you ever experimented on whether or not grass-fed milk makes a better and sweeter cheese than does grain-fed milk?
That's a great question, and there's very good research now that corroborates, that verifies that pasture, grass-fed, and particularly, you know, natural pastures that have lots of different botanicals, different flowering plants and so forth, that carries over into the milk and into the cheese, and not only is there some, you know, nuances of flavor and aroma that result from the pasture itself, but also there's some real health benefits in terms of you know, conjugated linoleic acids and other health promoting fats in milk that carry over into the cheese. There are, you know, anti-cancer, hypertension, lots of health benefits from milk.
Don't tell the vegans.
One of the
I tell it like it is.
Yeah,
it's a great story, and it makes you feel good about eating cheese. You know, for a while there was so much negativity about dairy. You know, saturated fat, cholesterol. Now we're realizing that a lot of that was way overblown, and some of it was just plain wrong.
Exactly.
And that there's actually a lot of health promoting benefits of dairy, both in terms of the protein and sort of bioactive peptides and immune stimulatory peptides that come from the protein, and then the fats that, like CLAs, that have health promoting.
Provided, of course, I would imagine, provided it's made the proper way. I would imagine it feels like grass fed cheese made the way the artisans did in its raw state, starting with raw milk. That just feels like, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw, after more experimentation, the science say that kind of cheese, because it's more unadulterated, it's more in its natural state, is better for you than is these industrial mozzarellas you put on your...
You mean Kraft singles?
Yeah.
I agree. Right.
What are Kraft
singles? Brand names, but...
Yeah. Yeah, but that kind of industrial cheese, what is the difference?
The thing that I find amazing about those little orange squares is just the texture and the floppiness. Like, how do they achieve
they
that?
They use gum arabic, or what do they do?
Well, if you know, the singles that you're talking about are a category of cheese called processed cheese, which has a different identity from a natural cheese, or a so-called natural cheese. Processed cheese is made from cheese, but it also has other ingredients added, such as what's called emulsifying salts. And the cheese and the additives are melted together in a processing kettle into a molten mass, and the salts cause the fat to be changed in its configuration, so it's very stable, so it's dispersed. and it congeals upon cooling into this, rubbery,
rubbery, a sort of rubbery non-food that you can you can bitch slap somebody with if need be. That's what it sounds like. Or attach it to a stick and it turns into a fly swatter, ladies and gentlemen.
It has a unique, we say a unique rheology.
Yeah, it has a uniquely non-cheesy quality to it.
but there, for some markets, that's what they want is a very high degree of stability. It's indestructible.
It's called economics.
Great thing for,
right.
Yeah.
Feed it to the school children, ladies and gentlemen. Throw it on hamburgers. Yeehaw!
Or just throw it. That's it also makes a great frisbee.
That's right. Or just throw it. Where would we be
without frisbee cheese?
Professor, I appreciate your time. I thought this was fascinating. It's both a history lesson, and I know now if I'm stuck in the wilderness with nothing but a cow and a bladder, and
you'll be all right.
I'll be all right. I'll need a baby cow too, so I'll have to breed the cow. So we'll figure it out. That's all.
There are so many other elements to talk about too, like cheese and religion. In the Old Testament, it talks about the land of milk and honey.
Right.
Again and again, milk, cheese, these show up very, very often in early religious texts.
You bet. And in religious practice, cheese was, for 3,000 years, was a constant item sacrificed to a litany of deities from one civilization to the next in time, over time. Cheese was used to placate the gods, to keep the weather good, keep the seasons, the harvest going, and so forth. So yeah, it was really important in terms of religious practice. And right into the Christian era, cheese has some interesting intersections with the church and religious practice.
Mm. You can just see me eating cheese in church.
One thing I really also did want to throw in, I found out about your book when I went to a cheese tasting at Murray's Cheese Shop in New York. And they said this was the definitive book on cheese.
Oh, that's a big deal, actually.
That is a
big deal. I know that cheese shop.
It's a great cheese shop.
Yeah.
They're great folks.
And one of the things they said, which I thought was really interesting, just to go back to the grass-fed thing, is that the cheese was yellow because of the carotene in grass. And when it was hay-fed, it wouldn't be as yellow. So the yellow was really a mark of, this being really fresh summer, really good cheese. And then that became a thing that was then imitated, where they would then dye the cheese yellow to give the feel of it
bastards,
being natural.
Bastards!
But I think we're so removed from that time that, we just sort of think, oh, cheese is supposed to be yellow or cheese is supposed to be orange. But it actually was indicative of what the cow's diet was.
That's right. And in defense of the cheese makers, they were pushed. This is particularly in England around, late 1500s, early 1600s. The cheesemakers were pushed by the cheesemongers in London, who they had to sell their cheese to in order to have a market. The cheesemongers wanted more butter from the cheesemakers. Cheesemakers supplied both cheese and butter. Cheesemongers said, "We want more butter per unit, per pound of cheese that you supply, because we can make a bigger profit on the butter." What that meant is the cheesemakers had to pull cream out of their milk before making cheese, and they were forced to make lower fat cheese, skim milk cheese.
Wow, because they needed
more
the butter.
And more pale.
Wow.
So the paleness of that cheese became a real problem, and the use of colorants to try and build up the color, the orange color, the yellow natural color, became almost a necessity just to try and sell the cheese. And so the cheese makers, in some respects, were pushed into using these colorants, which then became accepted, as you just said, as a sort of what we accept to be normal eventually.
Right.
And especially, like, that makes a lot of sense when you think about those English cheddars, which are often such bright, bright orange colors.
Yeah.
There it is. Well, ladies and gentlemen, get your cheese. Make sure it's orange, unless it's, an industrial cheese.
And Professor, never eat Parmigiano Reggiano that is not
at least I don't touch a Parmigiano that's not aged by 2 years. Professor Paul Kinstead, the book is called Cheese and Culture. If you want to know anything about cheese, and you should, that is the book. Thank you, sir, for joining the mother of all podcasts, sir.
Oh, well, thank you.
Hope to meet you one day in person when I go up to Vermont. Love it up there. Thank you so much.
Okay, come on up to Vermont anytime.
I will, man. I will.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And ladies and gentlemen, I mean, I'm not going to be in Vermont, but I'll be in San Diego this weekend doing stand-up, just tearing up at the American Comedy Club. You think this was funny? You think talking cheese was funny? Well, you see me live on the stage at the American Comedy Club, so come on down and see me. Hunter Motz, you're becoming a bit of a celebrity among my fans, at least, when they come to see my stand-up. They're like, yo, tell Hunter Motz. I get these really muscular dudes in their 20s who are like, bro, tell Hunter Motz he's the man, man. That guy's the shit. I'm like, I will do that. I will definitely do that. Thank you, everybody who came out. Ontario, thank you, Tempe. My crowds have been amazing, and we're selling out, and I'm very flattered, and I feel good, and I give some of the credit, at least, to this podcast. I get more excited when people have listened to this podcast than anything else, because I feel like we're really trying to get smart people a voice. I don't know. I just am amazed. I always find these conversations fascinating, and it warms my heart when some young muscle head with cauliflower ears and tattoos comes up and knows all the episodes. I can't tell you how good that feels. I really do appreciate it. So thank you very much to everybody. And I just got a little sincere there. Wish you guys could see me. I have just a tear. I don't mean to be cheesy, but hilarious. There's more at the American Comedy Company. San Diego. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.